And another thing that we're going to do that the church has been doing for thousands of years, we're going to open up the Bible and we're going to look at it. And we're going to ask God to speak to us because God wants to speak to us. God calls us together not to have a club or a group. God calls us together so that we can know him. I think God's desire is relationship. He wants you and I to know him. And so one of the big ways that happens is we communicate. Every relationship is built on communication over time. We talk, we listen. That's how relationships are built and strengthened. It's the same with God. God wants to speak to us and communicate with us. And one of the big ways he does that is through the Word, so the Bible. So we're going to open it up today. We're actually deep into Genesis. We've been going through the book of Genesis for a long time. We're nearing the end, but we're not there yet. And so we're going to pick up the story again. We've been talking a lot about Joseph, this young man in the Bible, and we're deep into the story of Joseph. We're into a long account of Joseph's family relations. Joseph, if you remember the story, Joseph was the favorite son of 12 sons. There were 12 boys in his family. Joseph was the favorite. His dad favored him. His brothers hated him for it. Really, truly hated him so much that they threatened to kill him and eventually sold him into slavery. While there, Joseph was enslaved. He was imprisoned. He was forgotten there. He had been sold into Egypt and a foreign country, and it looked like things were terrible, but Joseph began to prosper, and we saw the story of how Joseph, in all of the different circumstances he found himself in, as a slave, even as a prisoner, he prospered. He did well, and people thought well of him. And so his life has been going on to the point where he has become one of the most powerful rulers in the nation of Egypt. And so his life went from this teenage boy, probably, who was kind of living there. His brothers sold him into slavery, a terribly traumatic thing. Now 20-plus years has elapsed, and Joseph has been gone from his family that whole time. They were far, far, far away. He hasn't seen him. He hasn't heard from him. He's had no interaction with his family. The last interaction he had with his family was having his brothers decide not to kill him and instead sell him. That was the last interaction he had with his family. It's been 20 years, and Joseph has made a life for himself. He's married, he has kids, he's successful, he's prospered. He's in many ways become an Egyptian. He has moved into this place where he's just kind of had a life apart from his family. Now, all of a sudden, a couple weeks ago, we saw his family shows up. He didn't go looking for them. They came to him. His family showed up. His brothers showed up in Egypt looking for food. Joseph recognized them. And so we've been looking at this long, drawn-out back and forth. Joseph recognized his brothers. His brothers didn't recognize him. And so we've been seeing now, over the last few chapters of Genesis, this long back and forth between Joseph and his brothers, as his brothers don't know who this guy is. And Joseph, this powerful guy, is kind of pulling their chain a little bit. So we've been seeing this back and forth. If you haven't been here for the last couple of weeks, I would really encourage you to go listen to the messages. 2 weeks ago, Justin talked about how it became clear as Joseph and his brothers interacted that his brothers had been living with guilt for the last 20 years. And guilt is a powerful, powerful thing. God can use it, but left unchecked, it eats at us. It's like an acid that slowly chews away. Justin talked about that a couple weeks ago, how that their brothers had been living with guilt for 20 years. Last week, Mark talked about Jacob, the dad in this circumstance, and many of his failures, but he compared those failures to God. Jacob, as a dad, would not surrender his last son, Benjamin. In fact, he was willing to sacrifice the other 10, 11, didn't matter. Where God is so different. God is so different. He gave up his one and only son to win us. Mark talked about that last week. If you missed either one of those, I would encourage you to go back and listen to them because they're powerful messages. Today, we're still in that long, drawn-out back and forth between Joseph and his brothers, but today what we're going to do is we're going to look, focus more on Joseph here, okay? We're going to focus on Joseph, kind of what's going on perhaps in Joseph's heart and mind as this goes back and forth. So where we are is we are in the middle of Genesis 43. So if you have a Bible, you can open up. What we're going to do is we're going to read about a chapter here. We're going to go from Genesis 43, verse 15, through Genesis 44, verse 13. So it's about a chapter. It's not that long. I'm going to read a little bit. We'll stop and we'll talk about the little bit we read. Then I'll read a little bit more, okay? So we're going to read through this chapter, comment on it as we go. And then when we get to the end, we're going to ask, well, God, what might you teach us? What lesson is there in this for us, okay? So, if you want to follow along, I am reading in Genesis 43. I have the NIV, and I will just start reading, and we'll stop here and there and talk about it. So here we go, Genesis 43, starting with verse 15. So the men, Joseph's brothers, took the gifts and doubled the amount of silver, and Benjamin also. They hurried down to Egypt and presented themselves to Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of the house, take these men to my house, slaughter an animal, and prepare dinner. They are to eat with me at noon. The man did as Joseph told him and took the men to Joseph's house. Now the men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, we were brought here because of the silver that was put back in our sacks the first time. He wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys. Okay, let's talk about that for just a second. If you remember what happened the first time Joseph's brothers went down to Egypt, there was a famine everywhere in the land. Egypt had food because God had spoken to Joseph and told him about the famine ahead of time, so Joseph had prepared for it as a leader in the country. Egypt had food. Nowhere else in the surrounding world had food. So all of the world was coming to Egypt to get food. Joseph's brothers, where they were living up in Canaan, they didn't have any food because the famine was severe there, so they had come to Egypt to get food. When they came, Joseph recognized them. They didn't recognize him. Joseph didn't tell them who he was. But Joseph had a full brother, Benjamin, and Benjamin wasn't with them. Joseph had many half-brothers. Jacob, Joseph's dad, had four wives, and so a lot of these brothers are half-brothers. Joseph had one full brother, Benjamin. When the brothers were there the first time, they bought grain. Unbeknownst to them, Joseph put their money back in their sacks. They didn't know it. But he also kept one of their brothers and said, I'm going to keep this guy as a slave until you come back with your younger brother, Benjamin, because they had told him he had a brother. So that's the situation. The guys found the money. Their brother Simeon is back in jail. They went back home. Their dad's mad at him. It's just a mess. But now they've eaten all the food they got in Egypt, and they're starving again. And they say, we have to go back to Egypt and get more food. But Joseph had told them, you can't come back unless you bring Benjamin. They finally decided they were going to do it. They were going to come back. So that's what we see here. They've come back now a second time. They've brought their younger brother, Benjamin, with them. Joseph sees them, recognizes them again, sees Benjamin, although it's very likely he didn't know for sure who Benjamin was, because when Joseph last saw Benjamin, Benjamin was probably a very, very young boy. And now it's been 20-plus years later, so obviously Benjamin has changed quite a bit. But he sees this young boy, he sees his brothers, and he says, take him to my house. And so we see Joseph kind of continuing this intrigue. His brothers come again. Joseph still doesn't tell them who he is. He's kind of continuing this drama going on. Take him to my house, and I'm going to eat with them there. And these guys have no idea why that is. Obviously, they just came for food. And, you know, the last time they came, this guy told them they were spies and threatened to throw them all in jail and then took their brother and gave their money back. And this guy that's in charge of Egypt, if you look at it from the brother's standpoint, they got to be thinking, this guy's nuts. I mean, I don't understand why he's so interested in us. And Joseph won't tell him. He hasn't told them yet why. So Joseph is continuing the intrigue. Some commentators think that Joseph is testing his brothers. In other words, he did all this stuff before, put their money back, kept Simeon, their brother, in jail, told them they had to come back with Benjamin. Now he's doing all this other stuff. Some commentators, biblical commentators, say that Joseph is testing his brothers to see if they're still the same guys they were 20 years ago. That's certainly possible. That's certainly a possible idea. I wonder if Joseph isn't just vacillating. He doesn't know what to do with them. They're my brothers, but I'm really mad at them. They're my brothers, and now they're here, but I'd forgotten them, and now I have to deal with them. What am I going to do? I wonder if Joseph isn't just stirred in his soul, and he doesn't even know what to do. And so he's kind of not doing anything while he figures it out. I don't know. One way or another, Joseph continues the intrigue, but the brothers are not thinking straight. This is kind of funny to me. Sometimes you see, I see funny things in the Bible because it's just a picture of life, and life is funny sometimes. The brothers aren't thinking straight. Okay, the guy told us, you're going to eat at my house. So they're at the house waiting for him to come, and they start thinking, why are we here? I know why. He wants our donkeys. If he wanted your donkeys, he'd take them. He's got all the donkeys. He doesn't want your donkeys. But these guys are afraid. And when you're afraid, you don't think very clearly, do you? But well, these guys are afraid. They don't know what's going to happen. The last time they were here, Joseph threatened to throw them all in jail. He threatened to make them all slaves. And he'd taken Simeon and kept him in jail. Now, oh, he's going to do that, and he's going to take our donkeys. But they're afraid, and they're not thinking straight. All right, let's keep going here. Verse 19. So they went up to Joseph's steward and spoke to him at the entrance of the house. Please, sir, they said, we came down here the first time to buy food, but at the place where we stopped for the night, we opened our sacks and each of us found his silver, the exact weight, in the mouth of his sack. So we've brought it back with us. We have also brought the additional silver with us to buy food. We don't know who put the silver in our sacks. It's all right, he said, don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. I received your silver. Then he brought Simeon out to them. So the brothers think, well, we better explain this. You know, we got our silver back last time. Maybe that's why we're here. But hey, steward, we brought all that silver back and more silver to pay for this food. And so they just thought it was probably wise to explain themselves. Maybe there's just been a misunderstanding and we can clear it up right now. But the steward says an interesting thing. He says, yep, I got your money. In essence, he says, yep, you paid me. It's almost a business transaction. I got your silver the first time. You're good. You don't owe anybody anything. But then he said an interesting thing there. He said, your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. It's interesting to see the different ideas of God's role in this. If you remember back when the brothers came the first time and the money got put back in their sacks, they said this in Genesis 42, verse 28. I'll start with verse 27. At the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened his sack to get feed for his donkey, and he saw his silver in the mouth of the sack. My silver has been returned, he told his brothers. Here it is in my sack. Their hearts sank, and they turned to each other, trembling, and said, what is this that God has done to us? When the money got put back in the sacks the first time, the brother's response is, God is doing something to us. What did the steward say? No, God is doing something for you. That's a very big difference. The brothers thought God was doing something to him. What is he doing to us? What has he done? Well, you missed the point. God is doing something for you. I suspect that's a big reason why the brothers are afraid. They don't see God's hand in this. They don't at all. They think they're on their own. If they really believe God is taking care of us, well, okay, this is a confusing situation, but he'll take care of us in the face of this guy who's making all these threats. God can take care of us. But the brothers were not seeing God taking care of them at all. They saw God as maybe going after him. It was their guilt, perhaps, that Justin talked about. But one way or another, the brothers are afraid, and they don't understand God's role in all of this. Okay, let's keep reading. Verse 24. The steward then took the men into Joseph's house, gave them water to wash their feet, and provided fodder for their donkeys. They prepared their gifts for Joseph's arrival at noon because they had heard he was to eat there with them. When Joseph came home, they presented to him the gifts they had brought into the house, and they bowed down before him to the ground. He asked them how they were, and then he said, "How is your aged father you told me about? Is he still living?" They replied, "Your servant, our father, is still alive and well," and they bowed low to pay him honor. As he looked about and saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, he asked, "Is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went into his private room and wept there. All right, so Joseph comes and he interacts with his brothers. A couple things happened here. One, twice in this passage it says that the brothers bow down to him. And the reason that's significant, again, is because what happened much earlier in the story, a lot of the reason, one of the reasons that Joseph's brothers hated him so much was that Joseph had had a vision from God that this exact thing was going to happen. Back in Genesis 37, verses 5, 6, and 7, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream. Well, that's happening. That is exactly what's happening. Later, he had a dream where 11 sheaves bowed down to him, and the sun and the moon and the stars, and all of Joseph's brothers now are coming, and twice in this passage, and they did it once before, they're bowing down to him, and Joseph is seeing it. Joseph is seeing it. And Joseph is filled with emotion here. It's interesting, when you read this account of Joseph, it talks about him weeping as much as any other character in the Bible. Joseph is being stirred by emotion as all of this is going on. His emotions are just maybe all over the place. And it makes sense when you think about it. If you try to put yourself in his situation, perhaps, when he first saw his brothers, he might have felt intense anger. I remember what you did to me. I had forgotten it for 20 years, and now you're right there, and you have the gall to come to me and ask for food. I know who you are, and I know what you did, and maybe the anger just swelled in him. I suspect that it very well could have. Joseph probably also felt vindicated. Maybe he'd forgotten these dreams that God had given him. Maybe he'd tried to forget them because it got him in trouble in the first place, but I think he's remembering. In fact, it said the first time the brothers came and they bowed down, it said Joseph remembered the dream, and maybe he'd forgotten about it all these years, but now he's remembering something. Oh, God, you did speak to me all those years ago, and when you know, when you hear the voice of the Lord, it stirs you, it does something to you. When you know God has spoken to you, and many of us have felt that and seen that, probably all of us to some degree, when you hear that voice, something swells inside of you. And I think Joseph probably felt, oh my word, God, you did speak to me. And the reverence is very similar to love. It's a powerful emotion. And I think Joseph possibly felt that. Joseph might have felt intense sadness, because he saw his young brother and he didn't recognize him because he'd missed all of Benjamin's growing up. Those years were gone and he could not get them back. And maybe he felt intense sadness. Oh, my brother, I wish I had been there when all of your life was unfolding, but I wasn't. And you didn't see any of mine. And now, brother, you don't even know me. You have no idea who I am. And that he may have just been overwhelmed by sadness in seeing his younger brother. It's very possible that he also felt a deep longing that maybe he hadn't allowed himself to feel for a long, long time. I'm sure when he first got sold and he was a slave, and then when he was in prison, I'm sure he just dreamed about going home. Maybe dad will come for me. Maybe my brothers will change their mind. Maybe something will happen. Maybe I can escape. Maybe I can go home. He'd probably dreamed that for months and years. But as the years went on, in fact, it says that Joseph forgot all his sorrows. And now all of a sudden, there's his family again. And maybe he was just swept with a longing. Oh, this is my family. And I had banished them from my mind for 20 plus years, but now here they are, and I long to be with them. I don't know what it was, but something is making Joseph intensely emotional all through this story as we see his relationship with his brothers. And I think as we go on, I think what's happening is there is a love being rekindled in Joseph's heart for his brothers and his family. We'll get to that in a minute. All right, let's keep going. Verse 31 of chapter 43. After he had washed his face, he came out and, controlling himself, said, "Serve the food." They served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, for that is detestable to Egyptians. The men had been seated before him in the order of their ages, from the firstborn to the youngest, and they looked at each other in astonishment. When the portions were served to them from Joseph's table, Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as anyone else's, so they feasted and drank freely with him. All right. Interesting here. Joseph is starting to tip his hand, I think. He's starting to tip his hand. The brothers are seated by themselves, and the Egyptians are over here because Egyptians can't eat with Hebrews. But Joseph's all by himself as well. Well, if these guys were thinking clearly, they'd think he's not an Egyptian. he's eating by himself. He can't eat with the Egyptians. He's over there by himself. Wait a minute. Joseph's starting to tip his hand. And then he puts them in birth order. He knows who's the oldest and the youngest. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. What's going on here? Joseph's starting to tip his hand. Joseph's also doing something, and I don't know where this comes from, but he does the favorite thing. This has been the pattern in Joseph's family. Joseph was the favorite. His dad gave him the special robe. His dad gave him the special privileges. All the other brothers had to go out and work, but not Joseph. You just hang around home, buddy. Joseph was the favorite. He got the best and the most of everything, and now Joseph's doing the exact same thing with Benjamin. Everybody eat, but Benjamin gets 5 times as much as everybody else. Why is he doing that? I'm serious. Why? I have no idea. Why is he? I don't know. But he's showing the favoritism thing again. Maybe he's doing it to see how his brothers react. Certainly possible. He's doing it to see, well, you know, when this happened with me, you guys tried to kill me. I'm going to see what you do with Benjamin here. I don't know. That's possible. Maybe he just liked his brother Benjamin more. And he gave him more. We don't know. But Joseph does the same thing that his father had done. Shows favoritism. All right. Into chapter 44, verse 1. Let's keep reading. Now Joseph gave these instructions to the steward of his house. Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry, and put each man's silver in the mouth of his sack. Then put my cup, the silver one, in the mouth of the youngest one's sack, along with the silver for his grain. And he did as Joseph said. As morning dawned, the men were sent on their way with their donkeys. He didn't steal them after all. They had not gone far from the city when Joseph said to his steward, "Go after these men at once, and when you catch up with them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid good with evil? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from and also uses for divination? This is a wicked thing you have done.'" So Joseph does the exact same thing again. Remember when they were here the first time, he filled their sacks with grain, then put their money that they'd paid back in their sacks. Well, now he does the exact same thing. Fills their sacks with grain, tells the steward, put the money back in, but also he takes his special silver cup and he has it put in Benjamin's sack. Now, just one quick thing. It's interesting. He says that's the cup that Joseph used for divination. Joseph was a man who had heard from God. He had dreams. God had spoken to him. He'd spoken to him way back when he was a boy. He'd spoken to him when he was in jail. And so Joseph understood what it meant to hear God's voice. And yet it says he's using a cup for divination. Now, I don't know this, but divination is something that God says don't do as you read through the Old Testament. Divination, the implication there is that it's kind of sorcery. It's witchcraft. It's I'm gonna read the tea leaves. I'm gonna use the Ouija board or something, and some force out there is gonna tell me the future, not God. And God says, don't do that. I'm the only one that knows the future. What does this say about Joseph? I don't know for sure. I just offer this as a possibility. He's lived 20 years in a pagan culture, and culture wears off on us. It's not unlikely to think that the culture is beginning to wear off on Joseph. And this is maybe something Joseph will look back on later and say, gosh, that was a bad idea. For whatever reason, he has this cup that he uses for divination. He puts it in their sack. But in essence, what Joseph does is he does it again. He does the exact same thing he did before. And if you ask yourself why, I think maybe it's he just can't let these guys go. I just think maybe he can't let them go. These are my brothers. And I think as he's seen them now twice, and as he has interacted with them twice, and as he's seen his brother Benjamin, we don't know. It's possible that when the brothers were back home after the first trip and Simeon had been left behind, maybe Joseph had gone and spent time in jail with Simeon. We don't know. But I think Joseph's heart is just being drawn to these guys, and he can't let them go. I can't let them go. If they go back to Canaan, I don't know if they'll come back. I'm going to do something so I have a little. I'm going to keep them on the leash here. I'm going to keep them on the leash, put this money and the cup back in the sacks, and then he sends his steward after them. So we'll finish up in chapter 44, verses 6 through 13. When he caught up with them, he repeated these words to them. But they said to him, "Why does my Lord say such things? Far be it from your servants to do anything like that. We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver we found inside the mouths of our sacks. So why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If any one of your servants is found to have it, he will die, and the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves." "Very well then," he said, "let it be as you say. Whoever is found to have it will become my slave. The rest of you will be free from blame." Each one of them quickly lowered his sack to the ground and opened it. Then the steward proceeded to search, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. At this, they tore their clothes. Then they all loaded their donkeys and returned to the city. The guy catches up to him, says, "You've stolen." They said, "No, we didn't." And then the brothers make a very rash declaration. "We didn't steal anything. If you find it in any one of our sack, we'll kill him. And the rest of us will be your slaves." That was a rash thing to say. Remember the last time, guys, you were here? you opened up your sacks and found silver. Whoa, wait a minute. They made a very, very, very rash declaration that they regretted in moments, because as he began to open their sack, and I'm sure their hearts began to fall because they opened Reuben's sack. He was the oldest. They opened his sack and there was his money. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, no. Oh, no, not again. And then they opened Simeon's sack. He's the second. Oh, no, his two. Down the line, everyone's money is there. And then they opened Benjamin's sack, and there's the money and the cup. They jumped the gun. They spoke too soon, and I think they wished they hadn't. But they did something that for them is remarkable. They didn't abandon Benjamin. Remember what the steward said? "If I find the cup, that guy will be my slave. The rest of you can go free." Well, that's just exactly the deal they made for Joseph. "Yep, we'll sell him. We'll take the money, and you take Joseph as a slave, and we'll go back home." That was what they did with Joseph. Now, that exact opportunity is there. "You take the money and go. We'll take Benjamin as our slave." 20-plus years ago, they'd made that bargain. They'd made that deal. "Yep, we'll sacrifice our brother for money to get rid of him." Now it says they tore their clothes, and all of them went back. They did not abandon Benjamin to slavery when they could have. They could have, and they didn't. That's very different than the last time they were in this situation. All right, that's the story. That's as far as we're going to go today. Let's ask the question, what can we learn from this? What can you and I learn from this? Well, there's probably many things. I will offer one thing that I think I see in this, and that's this. I think family is worth fighting for. Joseph, when his family came to him in Egypt, he had a reason to get even with them. There was a reason for him to hate them and to take out his hatred on them. They had harmed him terribly. They had. They had hated him. They'd threatened him. They'd sold him. They'd lied about him. They'd forgotten him. He had a lot of reason to get even with his brothers when they came. He had a lot of reason just to let them go. Think about it. He had escaped the terrible dysfunction of his family. His family was a mess. I mean, we have read of all the things. One son is sleeping with his father's wives, and they're killing the neighbors, and there's favoritism. And this family is not, you know, a well-run, beautiful thing. And Joseph has escaped this. He has escaped, and he's prospered. He has a family of his own. He is successful. He is looked up to. He has position. He has all the things that you long for in life. And so Joseph has a reason just to let him go. Here, take this stuff and get out of here. I don't want to see you anymore. He could have done either. I suspect he was tempted to do one or both. I'm sure at different times in this long, drawn-out saga, he thought, I wonder if when he first saw him and he said, "You're spies, I'm going to throw you all in jail," if he thought, "Yeah, that's a good idea. I think I'm going to do that." Maybe he was very tempted to do that. I suspect he was. I suspect also he was tempted at different times, "You know what, I'd forgotten about these guys, and it was nice, and now they're here, and I'm all stirred up. I'm just going to send them home and forget about them." I suspect Joseph was tempted. He certainly had a reason to do either. I think he was tempted to do both. He chose instead to work really hard to restore his family relationships. When Joseph had every reason not to, he made a conscious choice to work really, really hard to restore his family relationships. He couldn't let them go. He kept bringing them back. He kept putting things in front of them to see how they would respond. He worked at this. He worked through his emotions to work hard to restore his family relationships when he wouldn't have had to. And when, if he wouldn't have, we probably would have said, "Yeah, I get that. I understand that, Joseph." Why? Why do you think that was? Why did Joseph work that hard? Why did he overcome what probably were his temptations to either be vindictive or just to be dismissive of his brothers? Well, I think that God gives us reasons. I think God helps us to understand that. You see, God created family, and he meant it to be a blessing. God created family, and he put all of us in a family, and he meant that family to be a blessing to us. In Psalm 128, it's a very short psalm. I'll just read it. "Blessed are all who fear the Lord, who walk in his ways. You will eat the fruit of your labor. Blessings and prosperity will be yours. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your sons will be like olive shoots around your table. Thus is the man blessed who fears the Lord. May the Lord bless you from Zion all the days of your life. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem, and may you live to see your children's children." I think five times in that psalm, God uses the word bless or blessing. And it's in the context of a family, your wife, your sons around your table, your children's children. God intended family to be a blessing, to be a source of blessing. And God put each one of us in a family with the understanding and with the intent that it would be a blessing to us in that family. God created family to be a blessing, and he put us there to bless us. And we feel that, I think, intrinsically. I think there's something inside of us that knows that that's true. That's why I think it says in Proverbs 17, verse 6, it says, children's children are a crown to the aged, and parents are the pride of their children. I think God put in us something that just longs for family. Little kids want to love their mom and dad. They just do. They want to. And if mom and dad do something dumb, they're so quick and willing to forgive. Old people like me, older folks like me, we look at our kids and we long for them. My kids have moved away and now they're having grandkids, and my heart just aches for them to go and be with them. There is something in us, intrinsically. God put something in us that longs for family. And I think Joseph was seeing that. Now, like Joseph's family, none of our families are perfect. We live in a fallen world. Every family is filled with people who are not perfect. Every family is filled with reasons to dismiss them or to be angry with them. That's certainly true. And yet, God can use your family as a blessing, and something in you longs for that. And so Joseph, I think, felt that, so he worked hard to make that happen. And I think we lose something if we don't work hard at our family of origin. I think we lose something. There's a proverb, Proverbs 28, verse 6. It's one of those proverbs Proverbs 26, verse 8. No, I just cannot get that right to save my life. Proverbs 27. I'm sorry. I was on all sides of it. Yeah, Proverbs 27, verse 8. Like a bird that strays from its nest is a man who strays from his home. Interesting little proverb there, and yet that is inspired by God, and it says something to us. I think we lose something if we stray from our home. I think we do. I think our family of origin is meant by God to be a particular blessing to us. Something in us longs for it. We lose something if we don't have it, and so what that means is it's worth fighting for. It's worth fighting for. Now, I understand family is not simple. I understand family is difficult. I don't know what your family of origin is like. Some of us have a family of origin where that's not hard to fight for. There's not that much to work through. Some of us have a family of origin where it's very difficult. Things have happened. Things have been said. Decisions have been made that are painful. And so it's hard. I don't know what your family is like. It's unique. And the things that you might have to fight for and the ways that you might have to fight for your family are different than mine, different than the people around you. And yet, I believe that you are blessed if you fight for it. God doesn't give us a guarantee that it's going to work. Joseph didn't have a guarantee that his family was going to respond to him. He didn't have that guarantee. We don't have any guarantee. We can't make our family do something. But I think we're blessed if we fight for it, like Joseph did. When we have reason not to. When you have reason not to fight to restore your family of origin, to restore those relationships, I think you miss something. And I think we're blessed if we do fight for it, just like Joseph did. Family is worth fighting for, and Joseph fought for his. Now, just very briefly, I'm going to make one more point. I think that's true of our family of origin. I think it's also true of our church family. Church is an interesting thing. It's not like any other institution in the world. It's different than anything else. God uses all kinds of words to describe church. He calls it a community. He calls it a flock, like a flock of sheep. And so it has characteristics of a community, characteristics of a flock. He calls it a nation, so it has characteristics of a country, of a nation. He calls it an army, so it has characteristics of an army. He calls it a body, so it has characteristics. It's kind of like a body. There are all of these things that it's like, and yet it's not exactly any of those things. One of the things that God describes the church as is a family. He says it's like a family. So the church, and by church I mean this local congregation, this congregation right here, similar to the one at harvest time across the street, or many congregations here in town or across the world, or through all of time, like we've been saying today, people gathering, God's people gathering in a church. It's like a family. It has characteristics like a family. Meaning, well, in Ephesians 3, verse 14, for this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom his whole family in heaven and on earth derives its name. He calls it a family. God is a father. It says Jesus is our brother. We're brothers and sisters. So the church, like a family of origin, was meant by God to be a blessing. And yet, this church, just like any family, is peopled with imperfect people. And so if you are part of this church or any church, there is always a reason to leave. There always is. Some words are said, decisions are made, actions are taken. It is not perfect. You will get hurt, and it's confusing. And you may think it's not worth it. Just like Joseph's family, there are always reasons to leave your church family because, well, we live in an imperfect world. You and I are imperfect people. Everybody sitting here has our things. And the more we jostle and interact with each other, the more sometimes we get hurt or confused or angered by each other. There are reasons to leave our church family. God knows this, and so he tells us ahead of time to fight for it. I'd read in Ephesians 3 there, just a few verses later, Ephesians 4, as a prisoner of the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. God knows that there will be reasons for you to leave your church family. He knows that. And so he says, hey, make every effort not to. Make every effort. Fight for it. Fight for unity. Fight for peace. Unity doesn't mean we all agree with each other. Unity doesn't mean we all think the same. Unity means that I'm with you and I'm connected to you. And there's peace between us, though you hurt me, though I hurt you, though you confuse me, though I can confuse you. God tells us to make every effort to work hard to stay in your church family. What does that look like? And now I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy, can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor, surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It's not proud. It is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. We read that passage at weddings, and rightly so. Speaks of this wonderful, the permanence and the power of love as a man and a woman come together in that relationship. But that passage was written in the context of a church. It was not written in the context of two people. It was written in the context of a church. The entire book of 1 Corinthians is how a church functions. Folks, all of those things, patient, love is kind, is not envy. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres, was written initially to us as a church. Persevere, trust, hope. Keep no record of wrong. Work hard to stay united. Work hard for your church family. That's the context there. That love chapter that we all know and stirs in our heart, well, initially it was written for us right here, us in the church. You see, we lose something, just like if you stray from your family of origin, I think you lose something. I think you lose something if you stray from your church family. Now, there are reasons to leave. I get that. I'm not saying that there aren't reasons to leave. But too often, we just stray. We just stray away because it's easier. I don't want to do the hard work to stay connected in the United, so I'm just going to stray and float away. You lose something. Instead, this family is worth fighting for. Let's fight to stay together. Let's pray. Father, thank you. Thank you, Lord, that you teach us and lead us and guide us. We just are so grateful, God. We are so grateful for the things you've given us and the way you lead us. Help us, God, to fight for our families of origin, and our church families. They're meant to be a blessing. Help us, Lord, to do what we can do to make that so. In Jesus' name, amen.